America Looks Abroad. This is the 45th in a series of broadcasts presented by the staff members of the Foreign Policy Association. Today's subject is British Empire Under Fire. The speaker is Mr. James Frederick Green, Foreign Policy Association expert who follows international events in Great Britain. And now, here is Mr. Green.
Good afternoon. On Friday, Hitler and Mussolini met and conferred again at the Brenner Pass. They had only one subject to discuss, how to defeat the British Empire. So far, Germany has failed to win a quick victory by air attack or invasion. "Keep your shirts on," Hitler said 4 weeks ago. "I am coming." The British kept their shirts on, but they are still waiting for Herr Hitler. At the moment, it looks as though Germany and Italy were planning to shift their attack from the English Channel to the Mediterranean, which is better suited to a winter campaign. If the Axis powers cannot carry out their invasion of Britain, the next best plan would be to capture either Gibraltar or Suez, or both. By gaining control of the Mediterranean, the Axis powers could end Britain's blockade of Europe. They could win over some of the countries that are still sitting on the fence, like Spain, Egypt, and Turkey. And they could cut one of Britain's lifelines to the Iraq oil fields, India and Orient. From the Axis point of view, such a shift to the Mediterranean would bring German airplanes against British bases and perhaps German troops and supplies into North Africa. From the British point of view, such a campaign would not be a total liability. The British might be able to send even more warships into the Mediterranean to harass and destroy the Axis lines of communication and to weaken and discourage Italy even further. Whatever the theater of war, Great Britain's home front remains a vital factor. Every American reporter and broadcaster in London pays tribute to British morale. There seems to be no indication that the British will not continue to fight at home and abroad. The cabinet shuffle in Britain last week suggests also no let-up in that country's war effort. Mr. Neville Chamberlain resigned for genuine reasons of health, but his resignation was welcome to a considerable portion of the public, who felt uneasy because the symbol of appeasement still remained in the inner war cabinet. Another member of the Chamberlain regime, Sir Thomas Inskip, now Lord Caldicote, was kicked upstairs from the Dominion's office to a purely non-political post, Lord Chief Justice. The other changes in Mr. Churchill's shuffle were really of less importance than our newspaper headlines made out. The war cabinet was enlarged from 5 to 8. Since Neville Chamberlain was constantly criticized because his war cabinet of 9 members was too large, especially in comparison to Lloyd George's 4 or 5 member cabinet in the World War, this increase is hard to understand. It probably can be explained, like the other shifts, by party politics. Winston Churchill is running a 3-ring circus with conservatives, liberals, and laborites all working together to defend Britain. Such a coalition is necessary, but it naturally increases the friction of personalities in the government. We must not forget that the Conservative Party is still the largest and most powerful in Parliament, and that it will remain so until a general election takes place. Neville Chamberlain, until his resignation last week, was leader of the Conservative Party, and therefore a powerful figure even though he was less in the limelight than formerly. One of his closest associates, Sir Kingsley Wood, Chancellor of the Exchequer, was brought into the war cabinet last week, and another, Lord Halifax, remains there as Foreign Secretary. It is certainly true that the Labour Party and its leaders, Ernest Bevin, Herbert Morrison, Clement Attlee, and H.V. Alexander, are gaining power and prestige, and that social reforms and wartime taxation are changing the face of England, but not quite so rapidly as some reporters have suggested. The Conservative Party, which has held power since 1922, with the exception of 2 brief intervals, is still strong and is still giving way very slowly. The latest shuffle doesn't alter the balance of power in the cabinet, but it partly meets the public's demand for change, though much dissatisfaction remains. The chances of a British victory, now that the war is in its 2nd year, depend not only upon Britain's home front, but upon the rest of the British Empire. Ever since Germany invaded Poland 13 months ago, this has been a world war, even though hostilities have been limited in area. The stakes in this world war are the rich possessions of the British Empire, occupying 1/4 the land surface on the earth, containing 1/4 the population, and controlling most of the 7 seas. To hold this empire and to maintain its sea power, Great Britain requires men and materials from the independent British dominions, from Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa, and from the parts of the empire that do not govern themselves, including India and the colonies, protectorates, and mandates. Next to Great Britain itself, The largest arsenal of the empire is Canada, which supplies foodstuffs, minerals, and manufactured articles. Canada was slow in getting underway because it was told by the British government to expect a long war of blockade and attrition. But after the Blitzkrieg started last spring, Canada began to speed up, and it is now getting into high gear. A party of American newspaper men was recently taken for a tour of Canada's defenses, covering 2,700 miles. They returned enthusiastic about the progress that Canada has made this summer, but they warned that Canada cannot make its full contribution until late in 1941. The most spectacular part of Canada's preparations, the training of pilots and the building of planes, has been speeded up as rapidly as possible. The Commonwealth Air Training Plan already has 4,500 men in training for active service, in addition to 7,500 student mechanics and maintenance men. Canadian industry is producing about 130 airframes a month, chiefly training planes, but has to depend upon American engines. Canadian manpower is also playing a part in defending the empire. Canada has more than 167,000 men under arms, of whom some 53,000 are overseas, in England, Iceland, Newfoundland, and the West Indies. The Canadians postponed conscription as long as they could, but this month the first group of conscripts go to camp for 30 days preliminary training. Canada is also using 6 of the 50 destroyers which we traded to Britain, and it is cooperating with us through the Joint Defense Board, which was set up last August, in working out a North American defense system. The two British dominions in the southwestern Pacific, Australia and New Zealand, are likewise speeding up their preparations both to help Britain and to defend themselves. Their hopes for a long war of blockade that would not require expeditionary forces have been shattered, and the two dominions now have many thousands of men stationed in Egypt and the Near East. Australia alone has 184,000 men under arms. Both Australia and New Zealand are training thousands of pilots and mechanics and are sending them as rapidly as possible to England. In this conflict, unlike the World War, Australia is manufacturing all its own light arms and ammunition and is turning out training planes at the rate of 3 a day. During the first year of war, there has been relatively little political change in either Australia or New Zealand. Australia had a general election last month, which did not greatly alter the division of power. As no one party has a majority in the Australian Parliament, the government is composed of representatives of the two largest parties, the United Australia and the Country Party, with the Labour Party in the opposition. The Prime Minister, Mr. Robert Menzies, hopes to persuade the Labour opposition to join his cabinet in order to form a really national government. The situation in the Union of South Africa is much more obscure than in the other dominions. A large part of the white population are Boers, descendants of the Dutch settlers who quarreled and fought with the English all through the 19th century. South Africa was seriously divided when war broke out last year. The cabinet split in two, and the Prime Minister, General Herzog, who favored neutrality, was forced to resign. He was replaced by General Smuts, who favored declaring war on Germany. The vote in Parliament was only 80-67. And that division of votes has not changed substantially in the past year. There are indications, however, that enthusiasm in the Union for war has grown in the past few months, when hostilities shifted to Africa. The Union of South Africa has moved troops northward into Kenya and Tanganyika in order to defend the British Empire from Italy. Economic and military mobilization has been stepped up since the defeat of France and the entrance of Italy into the war. One of the weak spots of the British Empire is India, where the demand of the Indian Nationalist Congress for independence overshadows everything else. The Congress Party demands immediate and complete independence for India, and the right of a constituent assembly to draft India's constitution. The British government, through the Viceroy, Lord Linlithgow, has refused to discuss these topics during the war, but has agreed to work out dominion status for India after the war. The Viceroy has invited representatives of different groups in India to join his executive council, but the Congress Party, the largest single group, has refused so far to accept. Mahatma Gandhi, the great Congress leader, has tried to find some compromise in line with his ethical principles. Gandhi has refused to stab Britain in the back, as he says, or to embarrass or injure the British in any way. he has called off his original plan for a civil disobedience campaign against the Indian government. Gandhi refuses, nevertheless, to give any active support to the British war effort or to renounce his demand for Indian independence. The situation has become much more difficult in the past year or two because the Muslim League, headed by Ali Jinnah and representing part of the Muslim population, is fighting with the Congress Party, which is largely Hindu, and seeking to increase the League's political power. Meanwhile, India is furnishing some men and material to the British war machine, especially in the Near East. Like the Dominions, India is much more of an industrial power in this war, and it can supply part of its own iron and steel requirements, as well as export raw materials. On every front, then, the British Empire is under fire. The main struggle is taking place in the British Isles, and it's in the British Isles that the war will probably be won or lost. But the Axis partners apparently cannot win without striking at parts of the Empire elsewhere, and the British cannot win without increasing help from the Empire. The Dominions, India, and the various colonial territories are all sending men and materials to the key positions and aiding the British Navy in patrol and convoy work. The real test of the Empire's strength will come when Britain attempts to take the offensive. If Britain can resist aerial bombing and prevent invasion this fall, it will have won its first victory of the war, but a purely negative victory. It will then have to undertake to win the second and more positive victory of gaining back territory and of taking the offensive against Germany. Such a campaign would require far greater contributions of men and machines than any of the Dominions are sending now, or even planning to send. If Britain should be defeated in the immediate future, the largest empire in the history of the world would become the spoils of war, plus the empires of France, Belgium, the Netherlands, and possibly Portugal, all of which depend on British sea power. Germany, Italy, and Japan would be ready to fill the vacuum left by these empires. They are now proclaiming that they have a new order ready for Europe and Asia. And we in the United States are taking out a little fire insurance for ourselves by rushing our defense preparations, leasing naval bases in British possessions in the Western Hemisphere, and collaborating with Canada and Latin America for defense. We should not assume, however, that our troubles are over just because Britain holds out against invasion this autumn, or because the war becomes a long stalemate or ends in a defeat of the Axis. The Pax Britannica, the British peace under which the world lived from 1815 to 1914, and to some extent even down until 1939, cannot be restored in its old form. Whatever the immediate outcome of the struggle, Great Britain will be seriously weakened and impoverished, and even less able than after the World War to re-establish peace and to promote economic recovery. Whatever happens to the British Empire, but especially if it should be defeated, the problems confronting the world in general, and the United States in particular, will be infinitely greater than those which confronted us at the end of the World War 22 years ago.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. James Frederick Green, Research Associate of the Foreign Policy Association, was today's speaker in the American Looks Abroad series. Mr. Green spoke today on the subject of Britain, the British Empire, under fire. If you would like a free copy of the talk, address your request to the Foreign Policy Association at 22 East 38th Street, New York, or in care of the station to which you're listening. The Foreign Policy Association is a nonpartisan organization open to all who are interested in American foreign policy. It offers accurate information on current world happenings. In the world of today, foreign affairs are your affairs. And now, beginning next Sunday, this program will be presented at 2:30 Eastern Standard Time. That's 2:30 Eastern Standard Time over most of these stations. We invite you to tune in at that time to hear another speaker in the America Looks Abroad series. This program has come to you from the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.